Well, I'm assuming that we meant what we sang, and that is the ideal prayer for today. Lord, speak to me that I may speak. Lord, teach me that I may teach. Because if you turn to 1 Peter, which is where we are this morning, that's right at the end of the Bibles on page 217, page 217, you'll discover that this is something of the theme of Peter's letter. He's been telling these Christians that God has chosen them out, and he's chosen them out that they may declare the wonderful deeds of him who called them out of darkness into his marvelous light. And he's beginning to explain to them how they need to live if they're to be that kind of people. And so we come today to the paragraph we're studying, which is 1 Peter chapter 2 and verses 13 to 17. Let me just read these words to you again. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to praise those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing right you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. Live as free men, yet without using your freedom as a pretext for evil, but live as servants of God. Honour all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honour the emperor. Someone asked me in the middle of the week what I was speaking on this Sunday, and I said I was speaking on the subject to every human institution, and they asked me why I needed to say that at St. Helens, which they didn't regard as the hotbed of revolution. And it quite put me off the track of the paragraph. Because it was only later on in the week when I began to study it more closely that I think I began to see what's behind this whole paragraph. And it's not quite the repressive picture that I think my friend had in mind. Will you focus your eyes for a moment on verse 16, please? Because I think this is a crucial verse to this paragraph. Live as free men, Peter is saying. Yet without using your freedom as a pretext for evil, but live as servants of God. It is actually an astonishing verse. All the more so, tucked into this particular paragraph. It made me want to go back and read the whole letter again. It speaks of a powerful freedom. And there are echoes of that freedom all the way through this whole paragraph. It explains why Peter had to write this paragraph. See, it's amazing, isn't it? He thought he needed to. What was he so worried about? Was it that all his Christians were rebellious Bolshevik types? Well, it may be, because there's always a smattering of that in all of us. We might dress it up more nicely, but it would have been there then. And yet it doesn't account for the language that he's using here. What made him think they would take on emperors and governors? See, the Christians to whom Peter is writing are a small, beleaguered minority. They are a bunch of nobodies. He writes in the next paragraph to slaves, but he doesn't say anything about masters. And many suspect that's because there were very few masters who were converted. They can't call on any famous people to come and give their testimony at their big meetings. They've got very little influence. They live in a day of authoritarian rule, dictatorship, not democracy is the order of the day, and few signs of perestroika echoing through the empire at the time. Oh, I picked up the Bible Society magazine this week, and it tells me how the door is open in Russia now. And glasnost has meant that they're allowing more and more Bibles into the country, so many that for the first time the Bible societies are caught dragging their feet. They can't cope. They haven't got the money or the Russian Bibles to send in as many as they're allowed. President Gorbachev is saying that believers have the full right to express their conviction with dignity. Perestroika and democratization concern them too, in full measure and without any restrictions. And the letter goes on to urge us to use this opportunity. Now, if that was the scene, you might imagine Peter writing this way to say, look, don't abuse things, don't rush things too fast. But that's not the scene. Peter still has to write this paragraph. The more I've looked at it, the more it strikes me that what he's writing here does not stem from conservatism, whether that has a small c or a big c, but it stems from this freedom, from this intoxicating liberty that he believes the Christians to whom he's writing are enjoying. You see, Christianity for Peter is not some repressive lid to keep people in place. It's more like a time bomb that could explode, and he's anxious to channel the energies. So verse 16 is all about a liberty that Peter expects his Christians to have. A liberty of knowing, as he's explained earlier in chapter 1, verse 4, that the world to come is the one that counts. Now, if I know I'm born anew to an inheritance which is imperishable, undefiled, unfading, kept in heaven for me, I can afford to be free of this world. The liberty of knowing that chapter 2 and verse 9 is how God views me. A chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people. See, Peter has written to them, hasn't he? He said, you are very, very special in God's eyes. I wonder sometimes if we've taken in verses like that. I wonder sometimes when I meet with people and talk with them whether they've let their self-esteem face up to a verse like chapter 2, verse 9. He can hardly put it more strongly, can he? How special the Christian is in God's eyes. A chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people. Well, Peter suspects that the ones to whom he's writing have. They've drunk of this powerful, heady wine. And that's why he goes on with this paragraph in verses 13 to 17. Its roots aren't so much conservative as radical. It's a powerful freedom that's surging through their veins. But it's a strange one too. See, look again what that verse says. Live as free men, he says, yet without using your freedom as a pretext for evil, but live as servants of God. Or, to translate the word completely accurately, live as slaves of God. Now that's very strange, isn't it? To mix freedom and slavery sounds odd to our ears. Because we often have a muddled concept of freedom. We often think of freedom in terms of freedom from restraints. We mix it up with license. We imagine perfect freedom will be when there are no restraints. But of course, such freedom does not exist. You can't have that kind of freedom. And when the Christian, who by definition is someone who's brought into relationship to God, when someone becomes Christian, they're not in a position of no restraints. No, they've got the restraint of their relationship with God. They've got the restraint of no evil. It's a freedom from evil, not a freedom for evil. Chris was a lad from the East End, a very much an East End family. He had a checkered past, to put it mildly, when he finally found his way out east to Norwich. And in a hostel he was staying in, he came across some other Christians, and there he came to a faith of his own. Some months after he started to get established as a Christian, he began to face up to his past. And that's where the problem started. You see, Chris had done a number of banks, so not with sort of machine guns and hoods, but in a slightly subtler, simple little fiddle, and fraud. It was actually a very successful one. The police had no record of it. They weren't chasing him for it. And he was debating in his own mind, did he have to go, now he was a Christian, to the police and confess to his crimes? Now, I'm sure, Chris, if I talk to him when I see him next month, I'm sure he'll admit that he had all sorts of mixed motives. He's no different from the rest of us. Some of them were better than others. For the purposes of this story, I'll tell them as if the best one was the one that was dominant. It may well have been. Finally, he went to the police, and he started to confess what he'd done. The police weren't at all thrilled to discover it. They didn't want to know. The sergeant behind the desk was appalled at all the paperwork it was going to involve him in, and as they had no record of the crimes, it wouldn't help them clear up any backlog of cases. So as Chris was confessing the crimes, they said to him, look, do you really want to tell us all about this? Yes, says Chris. You do realise what will happen, don't you? Yes, says Chris. You know you could get sent to prison, don't you? Yes, said Chris, but at least I'll be free. No, when you're in prison, they lock you up. Well, two of Chris's family had done time, so he knew that perfectly well. And he said, yes, I know, he said, but I'll be free inside. At that, the sergeant understandably gave up. There's not much point in carrying on arguing with someone who's going to speak like that, is it? I mean, it was baffling. To him, freedom is freedom from prison. Not a freedom that puts you in prison. And in some ways, verse 16 is as baffling to us, isn't it? For us, freedom is freedom from slavery. And yet here is a freedom that leads me into slavery. Live as free men, but live as slaves of God. Oh yes, I'm free to serve, but the one I slave for is God. This is the paradoxical freedom of the Christian. It's not just that the highest privilege is bestowed on the lowest servant, but the highest privilege stimulates the lowest service. That's the example of Jesus, isn't it? Remember, he was the one who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself and took on the form of a servant, a slave. And being found in human form, he humbled himself and was obedient unto death, even death on a cross. Well, here's the picture repeated here. Look, the Christian is described in verse 9 in terms of the highest privilege, a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people. And then the Christian is urged to take on the lowest service, be subject, verse 13, to every human institution. Be submissive, verse 18, to your masters with all respect. Be submissive, chapter 3, verse 1, to your husbands. Live considerately, verse 7 of chapter 3, with your wives. Be subject to every human institution if you're going to exercise this strange freedom. Actually, the commentators tell me that institution is a poor translation. That it really refers to God's creatures, the word. And that it would perhaps be better to translate it as be subject for the Lord's sake to all God's human creatures. Well, it's certainly the thrust of the paragraph. Verses 13 and 14 speaks of those who are in positions of power and authority. But by verse 17, it's been widened to all men. And we're told to be subject, to rank ourselves under. That's what the word literally means. Rank yourselves under all God's human creatures. Yes, the next world is our inheritance that we look forward to and we set our hope on. Yes, this world is in a sense a transit camp. And yet God has not left it without design and hope. And we must serve, we must rank ourselves under others. We can afford to. We have an inheritance. Yes, Christians are God's own people. Yet we're not to take that sentence in a spirit of exclusivism and arrogance, as if God has no interest in others. No, we must serve. See, when you come to verse 17, I don't think the important issue that Peter is making is the distinction between why we should honor some and love and fear others. No, I think it's actually the similarity. That's the thrust of the verse. That we're deferring to everyone. Certainly we're to love the brotherhood. That means Christians, not Masons. But we're to honor all men. Of course we're to fear God. And that word fear is reserved exclusively for a relationship to God. But we are to honor the emperor. And we're not to set one obligation up as absolving us from the others. We've got this strange liberty as Christians. We're free to be bottom of the pile. A powerful freedom, a strange freedom, a servant freedom. That's what he's speaking about in the whole of this paragraph, isn't it? We are free to serve God, and therefore we'll serve others. Why are we to do it? Well, he explains it, I suppose, in essence, in that little phrase at the beginning of verse 13. Rank yourselves under all of God's human creatures for the Lord's sake. And then he goes on in the paragraph to give us clues, at least two of them. Why we should live like this for the Lord's sake. And the first comes in verse 14. We're to live like this. We're to be willing to serve and to rank ourselves under others in this way because by faith we see that God has ordered human life in this way. And as we put ourselves in this position, we're submitting to the Lord. Look how he puts it. Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor supreme or to governors as sent by him, to punish those who do wrong and to praise those who do right. Just keep a finger in 1 Peter and turn back to our other reading, will you? And you'll see the same thoughts echoed. Romans chapter 13, it's page 152. Here's the Apostle Paul writing. Romans 13, verse 1, let every person be subject to the governing authorities. For there's no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, he who resists the authorities resists what God has appointed. And those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of him who's in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good. Now, isn't there something very similar to that in what Peter is writing in chapter 2 and verse 14? The emperor and the governors are there to punish those who do wrong and to praise those who do right. Yes, this is a paragraph about the responsibility of citizens, but implicit in it is the responsibility of the state. When I did history, I heard a lot about the divine right of kings. But the Bible also knows a lot about the divine responsibility of kings. They are to act as God's representatives. They are, in a sense, to represent God as judge, giving active expression both to his righteousness and to his wrath. They're responsible, according to verse 14 here, not just for our material well-being, but for our moral well-being. Did you notice how he phrased it? To punish those who do wrong and to praise those who do right. That's what those in authority are obligated to do. When political parties vie for the moral high ground, as they put it, that's the right thing to do, isn't it? They have an obligation to have the moral high ground. We may well dispute whether some of them have it from time to time. But they're stumbling on this truth. And it's because God has ordered human society in this way and given authorities for this purpose that we're to submit to them as part of our submitting to God. Now, it's easy to talk like that, isn't it? The last four times I've looked at this paragraph in a Bible study, I've never got this far before the questions, which are all 20th century questions, have been raised instantly. And I'm assuming that you'll be no different from everyone else we've looked at it with, and they'll be on your minds. And everyone's saying it's all very well to speak like this, but the situation's vastly different. This was a first century dictatorship. We're in a 20th century democracy. Is it still relevant? Well, why not? I mean, of course there are huge differences. Peter would never have imagined having the vote. And I don't think there's anything in this paragraph that tells me you can't vote against a government. But why abandon the principles? Well, you say, because governments don't live up to verse 14. The 20th century is full of tyrannies. When we're faced with a Hitler, are we meant to lie down and take it? Now, let me sound a warning note. Theologians have debated just where you draw the line on these verses for centuries. I am not going to crack it in 2 minutes. I'll have a go, but I'm not going to crack it in 2 minutes. Let me just make these comments. This isn't a 20th century problem. Before we want to write these verses off because of the likes of Hitler, we need to remember that the emperor of whom Peter is speaking was almost certainly Nero. Yes, he knows that issue. He knows that governments abuse their power. And he's not talking about it here. That's not the situation he's addressing. Yes, he's speaking constantly about doing right, all the way through the letter and all the way through this paragraph. So I take it that I can't disobey the Lord for the Lord's sake. If the government orders me to do something that is wrong, I can't hide behind verse 13 as an excuse for doing evil. I'm to live as a free man, but not let my freedom be a pretext for evil. Peter himself faced the situation, and that was how he acted. Just turn back, if you like, to look it up. It doesn't matter terribly much if you don't, but Acts chapter 4. You'll find the situation. He and John were arrested. They'd performed a miracle outside the temple. They'd started speaking to the people. They'd been arrested for a breach of the peace or something like that. And when they'd been interrogated, they couldn't find much wrong with them. And so they then told them they were free to go as long as they shut up. But verse 19 of Acts chapter 4, it's page 115, Peter and John answered them, "Whether it's right in the sight of God to listen to you rather than to God, you must judge. For we cannot but speak of what we've seen and heard." Now, he's putting it very graciously, isn't he? He's actually recognizing their position as authority. But he's also making it very clear what he's going to do in this situation. Well, you put us in a position of obeying either yourself or God. You'll make up your minds what you think of that, but we're going to obey God. We can't but speak of what we've seen and heard. And I don't think when he comes to write his letter here that he's changed his mind and gone back on it. I can't disobey the Lord for the Lord's sake. Now, if I'm asked to do wrong, I must stand up and be counted. But please, understand that all of that is, in a sense, an aside. If I'm so eager to make sure I don't do wrong, well, I'll spot that moment, I suspect. Verses 13 to 17, this paragraph is wanting to put a restraint on me when actually that kind of a question is a mask for my rebellious spirit, or alternatively, for my sensing that my freedom as a Christian allows me to turn over all other restraints and authorities. It's one thing to stand up when I'm asked to do wrong. It's another thing if I dislike the policies, or I shall suffer as a result of them. To be the confessing church in Nazi Germany Why, I doubt that this paragraph is written to prevent that. But not to pay the poll tax? I doubt that's in the same league. I'll have to fight that one a different way. No, I'll need to come to terms with my own spirit, won't I? I'll need to understand in what spirit I think I'm being unsubmissive. A spirit of rebellion is not good enough. A spirit that's just drunk too much of intoxicating freedom and not understood that that's a freedom to serve. And that's a freedom that means I will slave for God and submit to his authorities. Well, I need to understand that. For the Lord's sake, I'll rank myself under, even when it costs me. Because that's the way he's ordered society. For the Lord's sake, I'll rank myself under. Second reason, verse 15. Because it is God's will that by doing right you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. I'll do it for his name's sake, for his reputation's sake. I may not care much about mine, but I should care about his. Peter is worried that the talk of foolish men, the talk that's based on ignorance, may well disrupt and hinder and impair the gospel work. There's always been such talk. It's always been the way. It was true in the earliest days. Christians were accused of the most extraordinary and outrageous things. They were accused of cannibalism because of the communion service. There was foolish talk based on ignorance, that they were eating the body of Christ. Well, you see it still today, don't you? There's nothing like as outrageous and nothing like as damaging, but you could just see how easily it could come. Almost any newspaper article I read over Mission 89 was a sort of marvelous, gentle send-up of the fact that we Christians are basically oddballs. Oh, no doubt it's excused in terms of journalistic language and so on, but once you've got people as a lovely group of oddballs, it's just a small step to abusing them, isn't it? And Peter is anxious that for the gospel's sake, this kind of prattle should be put to silence, should be muzzled. That's what the word says. And the way it's done is by doing right. Now notice that. Goodness silences ignorant prattle. Not knowledge, goodness. If you think about it, it's true, isn't it? So there's a sense in which it's almost impossible, short of their being converted, to give the ignorant the knowledge they need to stop them speaking foolishly of Christians. But sheer goodness will silence their accusations. You get to the stage, don't you, where you say, oh, just a second, whatever is in it with these funny Christians, they can't be as bad as people are saying, because the ones I've met aren't like that at all. There's a gospel motive for living this way, a gospel reason. And Peter wants that to hold us to it, our love for and our concern for the gospel. It occurred to me as I was coming in this morning that when we speak of Christian service and ask each other, you know, what Christian service are you involved in, we mean things like, are you teaching in the Sunday school, or are you going on a cipher house party or something like that. Peter's got Christian service and slavery far wider, hasn't he? How do you live as a citizen? Oh, yes, you say, but I'm there to declare the gospel. Yes, well, Peter's very anxious for that. He's ordered us to declare the gospel. In verse 9, he's telling us how to live out that declaring of the gospel in these paragraphs. You know, our lifestyle defines the gospel too, doesn't it? It speaks of what the real freedom is. the real revolution is, the real power is. And it is this strange paradox, this servant freedom. Live as free men. Let me end on this note. You see, all that he's saying in this paragraph is voluntary. It is not meant to lead to the subservient doormat any more than it's to lead to tacit acceptance of every evil regime. We're to live as free servants. Have you wondered why Christians always appear to be such threats to tyrants? Have you ever prayed for other parts of the world? You discover we're quickly asked to pray for persecuted Christians in authoritarian countries. It's almost always what one's asked to pray for when there are totalitarian regimes. And the reason is because it is very hard to get Christians exactly where you want them if you're a dictator. And this paragraph doesn't stop that. You see, I may get you to do what I want you to do, but I'll never get you to do it for the right reason. I'm obeying in this paragraph not because of the king. I'm obeying because of the King of Kings. I'm obeying because of the Lord's sake. It's the despair of dictators, I suspect, who long that we'll obey because of them. Now, they sense in Christians everywhere, don't they? People who will live under a higher authority than them. And Peter does not write verse 13. To put me under some lower authority. No, I'm to live as free men. But slaves of God. Look, let's just come back to Jesus' teaching. One last cross-reference to show this. It's this delight of this voluntary submission. Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5 and verse 40 and 41. If any would sue you and take your coat, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. See, isn't this the despair of the oppressor? I think I've got you in an arm lock because I insist that you give up your coat to me. So I give you my coat and I say, oh, don't worry, have my cloak as well. I force you to go 1 mile and I show that actually I'm not just obeying you, I'm obeying a higher authority. I'll willingly go 1 mile. Let me go 2. Where does that leave me? Cowed? No. Free. Where does that leave me? Subservient? No. Free. Where's this paragraph meant to leave me? Just a cipher? Some digit? Caught up a tiny cog in some giant human institution? No, free. Live as free men. Yet without using your freedom as a pretext for evil, live as slaves of God. This intoxicatingly powerful, this paradoxically strange servant freedom. Now that's what I've got to wrestle with if I'm to live as a Christian. Let's pray. Our sovereign God, we thank you for your gracious and generous freedom. We thank you that in your mercy you call us to be your people. You set us free. And we acknowledge again that there's within us a selfishness that will abuse the highest of gifts. And so we ask that you'll teach us not just to rejoice in your freedom, but to live as slaves of God. For your name's sake, Amen.